It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Is Washington ready to get serious about cutting the budget?
Even if it is, some of the numbers don't seem to jibe.
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for checking out the podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Thursday, April 14th.
Coming up, Goldman goes under the microscope again. There are big questions about the future of BP as shareholders meet in London. And Burger King's answer to, I just don't eat enough meat.
A lot of people are saying that, apparently. All that ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
There's likely to be a vote today in the U.S. House and Senate on the budget compromise that cuts billions of dollars from this year's federal spending. And it's just a day after President Obama outlined his own long-term plans to trim the deficit with spending cuts and higher taxes on the wealthy.
Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us now from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Diane, the president made his big speech yesterday on deficit reduction. We got the Republican plan last week. Everybody's talking about trillions of dollars in cuts. And yet I see this morning that the Congressional Budget Office says that the $38 billion in cuts that was announced last week to keep the government running actually only amounts to a deficit cut of about $350 million, which makes me ask, are they getting serious about debt or not?
I think the rhetoric has far exceeded the reality. We certainly see a lot of talk about deficit reduction and long-term changes, but we're really not doing it. The Ryan plan has tax cuts in it, not tax increases, with spending cuts, and in fact, they pretty much weigh out, even out over time, and some of the economic assumptions are just ridiculous, with things like millions of homes being built in the short term to offset what could be a drag from fiscal drag. On the other side of it, you can't just revoke the Bush tax cuts and have everything be fine. We need to fundamentally reform taxes in this country. And I think that's where we're still missing the mark, is that no matter what, the only way out of this is looking at both sides of the balance sheet, and that's both revenues and expenditures, and start thinking about it in a more thoughtful way.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In his speech yesterday, the president didn't say anything about raising the debt ceiling. Indeed, some lawmakers are being more vocal about the possibility of voting no to raising the ceiling unless mandatory spending cuts are included. From Washington, here's Marketplace's David Gura.
In just a few weeks, the national debt is expected to reach $14.3 trillion. If some lawmakers attach conditions to borrowing more, that fight could lead to default.
The D word is very scary.
That's Guy Labat with financial services firm Janney Montgomery Scott. If the U.S. defaults, federal programs paid for with bonds could stop. Banks that hold treasuries would restrict lending, and experts say the economy could tank.
You know, you've got two parties driving towards each other at high speed. If nobody blinks, everybody loses big.
Banking consultant Bert Ely says this fight could go down to the wire.
But I think at the end of the day, everybody realizes that it would be very detrimental to the federal government and ultimately to the American taxpayer for any kind of actual outright default on federal debt.
We'll see who blinks first. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
A new bipartisan Senate report has some fresh evidence of what some of the big banks did as the housing bubble popped and afterwards. And one of those banks, Goldman Sachs, is being accused of misleading congressional investigators. Marketplace's Elisa Roth is with us from New York with more on this. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell us what this report says.
The committee looked at almost 6,000 pages of emails and other documents from banks like Washington Mutual, Goldman Sachs, as you said, and Deutsche Bank. There doesn't seem to be evidence of out-and-out fraud, but the report makes it clear the banks were looking to profit from the booming real estate market and then rushing to figure out how to survive when it collapsed. Goldman Sachs is a centerpiece of the report. Democratic Senator Carl Levin, one of the two senators to sign off on the report, wants the Justice Department to look into whether Goldman misled clients. And he says federal prosecutors should think about bringing perjury charges against Goldman executives for telling Congress the bank didn't bet against the housing market and against its own clients to make money.
Why would Goldman deny what is so obvious, that they were engaged in a huge short in the year 2007? Why would they deny it? Because they gained at the expense of their clients.
And by the way, unlike some earlier investigations into the financial crisis, this one was really bipartisan. Tom Coburn, the Republican senator from Oklahoma, also signed off on it.
And is the report recommending any solutions?
It is. Some of these have been taken care of by Wall Street reforms in places like the Dodd-Frank bill. But the Senate panel also suggests that regulators should check mortgage-related securities to be sure they're not breaking any laws, and that we should consider how risky lending practices could affect the financial system as a whole.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth in New York. Thanks.
You're welcome.
The number of people filing for first-time jobless benefits unexpectedly rose to 412,000 last week. That's according to the Labor Department. It's the first rise in 3 weeks, and the four-week average was up as well. Swiss pharmaceutical giant Roche said demand for its cancer drug Avastin fell in the first 3 months of the year. Profit at toy maker Hasbro is down by more than 70% because of weak demand. Later today, we're going to get earnings from Google.
The government said today wholesale prices rose slightly in March, mainly due to higher gasoline costs. And we got a report on personal computer shipments. Sales of those big, bulky desktops slipped last quarter, Steve. They were down 3%. Analysts say that's because why? We're buying all kinds of new products. What could that mean?
We like to take our computers with us.
Tablet computers. It's the iPad.
For more numbers, check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
To the global perspective now, and less than a week before the one-year anniversary of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, disgruntled BP shareholders are meeting in London for the company's annual get-together.
But the focus of the meeting isn't so much the spill, it's Russia, where the company was hoping to make a lot of money down the road. The BBC's Rob Young is outside the shareholder meeting in London, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, first of all, explain what's going on behind you. There's some protesting happening.
Indeed, there is. There are dozens and dozens of protesters from all over the world who've made the journey here to London, including some people from the US Gulf Coast. They've come here to ask some pretty tough questions of BP's management, particularly in relation to compensation and also the continuing impact on the environment of last year's Gulf spill in the Gulf.
And I gather that the big story of the meeting over there has to do with this big Russian oil deal. Tell us about that.
It does. Thursday was supposed to be the deadline for BP and Russia's Rosneft to finally agree to go ahead with a massive $16 billion deal to access potentially vast reserves of oil and gas in the Russian Arctic. And that could be very lucrative for BP. But the deal is at risk of collapsing because of objections from BP's partners in another Russian venture. The deal should have reduced BP's reliance on oil from the United States. But this deadline has now been extended by another month. But shareholders here aren't happy. Indeed, one person has described BP's handling of the whole affair as a complete shambles.
The BBC's Rob Young in London outside the BP shareholder meeting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Swiss-based company Glencore wants to go public. Glencore is the world's largest commodities trader, and up to now it's been a pretty secretive firm. So will going public and all the scrutiny that goes along with that hurt Glencore? From London, Christopher Worth reports.
Glencore's $11 billion offering would be the largest in London's history, but the company's reputation for secrecy is part of what has allowed it to become a commodities giant. It got its start in the 1970s under Mark Rich, who was pardoned by President Clinton for charges of tax evasion and cutting deals with Iran. Today, it has big stakes in everything from zinc and copper to oil, coal, and natural gas, with $145 billion in sales last year. Angus Campbell is with London Capital Group. He says going public means Glencore will now have to be more open with investors. But will that hinder its ability to grow?
I think that actually it will have the exact opposite effect, in that the ability to be able to access funds from global investors will help the company to expand.
But the company doesn't seem to be all that worried about public relations. It's also announced that embattled former BP chief Tony Hayward could be taking a senior role in the company. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
A group of leading world economies say they're open to re-evaluating whether the U.S. dollar should be the world's main reserve currency.
Now, leaders from the five so-called BRICS countries, that includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and the newest member, South Africa, just wrapped up their one-day summit in southern China. And the BBC's Juliana Liu is close by in Hainan with more for us this morning. Hello, Juliana.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. The BRICS want to move away from the U.S. dollar. Why?
If you think about it from their point of view, say you're Brazil and you want to trade with China and you want to sell widgets to China, why should you not settle that trade in your own currency if you can? Why allow yourself to be held hostage to the rate that the dollar is trading against your own currency? So from their point of view, they simply want to minimize risk. And if they are big enough so that their currency can be accepted as a way of settling world trade, why not?
The U.S. and China, Juliana, have been duking it out over the currency issue for a long time now. Is this just China's way of sort of using its power to gain allies in that fight?
I think China is generally using its power to gain allies. Here in China, it's almost accepted that within 10 years or so, the Chinese currency will become freely tradable. It just wants to do it at its own timetable, not subject to pressure from outside. I think what you're seeing now with the BRICS is something far more fundamental. These countries, their economies make up 20% of economic activity around the world. They want their voices to be louder in the international monetary system.
Juliana Liu in Hainan, China. Juliana, thank you.
Thank you.
In Cuba this weekend, the Communist Party Congress will mark 50 years since the failed U.S.-led Bay of Pigs invasion. And at the annual summit, Cuba's socialist leaders will ask the assembly to sign off on some free market economic reforms. From Havana, reporter Grant Fuller filed this report on how that's affecting Cuban entrepreneurs.
In Baracoa, the oldest town in Cuba, it's festival time. There's reggaeton music and, as usual, state-run fried chicken stands. But also, young men run private roulette tables, women sell cookies and bubblegum, and a man carries around a rack of hats for sale. This is Cuban-style free enterprise at work. Last October, President Raúl Castro promised to slash 500,000 jobs from Cuba's inflated government payroll. To cushion the blow of those job cuts, he announced a new venture into the private sector. More than 170,000 Cubans now have self-employment licenses for everything from carpentry to childcare.
This is the best thing the Cuban government has done to help us.
Lázaro Delgado got one of the new permits to sell flowers on the street in Havana.
They're giving everyone the chance to work, helping us all start doing something. We can do anything we want as long as we keep our part of the bargain. The state is giving us a chance to make it.
But don't forget, it's still communist Cuba, and taxes are sky high. Small business owners give back up to 40% of their annual income, and they pay a high monthly fee on top of that. There's also a lack of startup capital. Government banks announced a plan to provide limited credit for the self-employed, but that program has yet to get rolling. I'm talking to a woman who works at a Havana office that issues the new licenses. She refuses to give her name for fear of losing her job. She says many Cubans have become so fed up with the slow pace of change that they've returned to her office to give their licenses back.
They thought having their own business would make things better, but they can't come out on top because the taxes are so high. So people are giving up their licenses more than the government expected.
The new business owners hope this weekend's Communist Party Congress will be a chance to further tweak the system in their favor. in Havana. I'm Grant Fuller for Marketplace.
Virgin Airlines owner Richard Branson, Jeremy, is going to honor this bet that he made with AirAsia CEO Tony Fernandez. Yeah, the two wagered last year on whose race team would finish higher in the 2010 Bahrain Formula One Grand Prix.
Yep.
Right. Like, when I bet someone, it's usually $5. Yep. But when these two, you know, high rollers bet, it's, you know, there's all kinds of stuff going on. Who's going to win the Grand Prix and all of this? Well, Branson lost the bet.
Uh-huh.
So on May 1st, aboard AirAsia's 13-hour London to Kuala Lumpur route, the billionaire Branson will be your flight attendant.
Oh, wow.
Complete with high heels, a bright red dress, and shaved legs.
Wow. They don't mess around. They do not mess around. Today, Zipcar is going public. The car-sharing company, which is popular among city dwellers and college students, was founded about a decade ago, and it's grown to more than 500,000 members since then. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Zipcar has ironic ads, cool cars, and a growing customer base. It even bought a competitor in London. But there's one thing Zipcar doesn't have: profits.
Yes, after 10 years, I would think they should have shown a profit.
Michael Millman's a rental car analyst and isn't convinced Zipcar will succeed. But Kathy Smith's more optimistic. She researches new IPOs at Renaissance Capital.
The company is making money in the early markets that it has started.
If you break it down, the company's turning a profit in Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. And Smith says Zipcar's plowing that cash into new markets.
So the reason it's not making money is it's expanding very quickly.
Smith thinks Zipcar could spark a new multi-billion-dollar industry, but even she expects bumps in the road. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
I think, Jeremy, we should pay homage to the man with the fast fingers and the really nice writing utensil. Hmm. You know about this guy, Czech President Vaclav Sticky Fingers Klaus, who was on camera and being recorded while secretly grabbing and pocketing this jewel-encrusted pen at a signing ceremony. They were signing some sort of treaty between Czech Republic and Peru.
Stole the pen.
He stole the pen. He slipped it in his pocket, actually very cavalierly. And the video on YouTube has gone viral. The incident has overshadowed a political crisis that was actually gripping the country. From Prague, here's the BBC's Rob Cameron.
This video clip has now been viewed by almost 2 million people around the world. Seated next to the Chilean president, Mr. Klaus examines the pen, encrusted with jewels, sneaks it ever so craftily into his lap, then slides it into his pocket. Nora Friedrichova, whose Czech TV show first aired the clip, said the president had become a fair target of jokes.
The president is the very same human being as we are. And if we catch a situation like this, we always put it in the air. The president is not the first person we published something like that about. And his reaction actually was quite nice, I would say.
Others defend the president, currently busy trying to stop the government from collapsing, saying they couldn't understand what all the fuss was about. That hasn't stopped a group of protesters from starting a Facebook campaign, with more than 7,000 people promising they'll pop a pen in the post to the president because it looks like he needs one. In Prague, I'm the BBC's Rob Cameron for Marketplace.
There is a big meeting about meat going on in Chicago today. It's the International Meat, Poultry, and Seafood Convention. And the story so far is that consumers are buying more meat now that an economic recovery is underway.
But the return of carnivorousness is putting pressure on food and water supplies. And that's leading some to the new and improved world of fake meat. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Chicken can be tasty.
I love it.
Just ask Harold Huff, a researcher at the University of Missouri.
Flavor, feel, versatility. You know, it's great in casseroles.
The problem is, to make that chicken casserole, well, you've got to have a live chicken. And that chicken needs water and grain to eat and a place to live, and it'll have to be killed. Or maybe you don't. In a laboratory at the University of Missouri, a food extruder spits out long, thick ribbons of fake chicken. It's made from a dry soy powder.
from dry feed in to product out once it's up running and stable can vary as little as 15 seconds.
A whole lot faster than growing a real chicken. Huff and Dr. Fu Hung She have been working on making passable fake chicken for a decade and a half.
If it doesn't feel right when a person chews it, if it doesn't look right on the plate, people are turned off by that.
And so Huff and She had to figure out how to make their soy chicken not just taste like chicken, but have the texture of real chicken and look like chicken instead of a big gray blob. So they extruded and extruded and extruded until they came up with a better analog chicken strip. Now, more than 15 years later,
another bowl of some sort.
Ethan Brown is cooking the mock chicken strips up with some tomatoes, onions, and spices to make fajitas. He and his company have partnered with the university to get Dr. Shea's chicken to market. Brown thinks the demand for better fake meat is there, driven by health concerns, worries about how mass-farmed animals are treated, and the environment.
Climate change is a big issue. We had talked about, the UN came out with a study saying 18% of greenhouse gas emissions are due to livestock.
Greenhouse gases are responsible for rising global temperatures. Brown serves up his fake chicken fajitas that taste a whole lot like real chicken fajitas. Appetizing? Your call. But it points to a future with a whole lot less clucking. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
And if you want to see fake chicken, we've got a video up on our website, by the way, at marketplace.org.
And finally, from fake chicken to real chicken and onions and tomatoes and bacon and cheese and, of course, two hamburger patties.
Well, you're making
Steve.
Me hungry, man.
Those are the ingredients of the new meat monster from Burger King.
Oh.
It is certainly a calorie monster. It has 1,100 calories.
Wait, beef and chicken.
It's got
sandwich.
Beef and chicken in the same and bacon.
So you got beef, chicken, and pork.
That's
all there.
Right. That's right.
Some bologna and take care of all
there's
that.
There's more salt in this thing than four bags of potato chips.
Oh, my gosh.
It costs about $10, but thankfully for our waistlines, for the moment, it is only available in Japan.
Thankfully for our waistlines. Oh, my goodness.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Chicken and beef and pork. It's amazing. I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.